Ah, there we are, back from the 80s, of course, and the sheer magic of Giorgio Moroder and Philip Oakey there together in Electric Dreams. Okay, well, we can't ignore it any longer in any way, shape or form. We have to point out that, yes, the Midweek Drive and Adventures in Audio, Siren FM Southside broadcasting calendar is actually out, but it's just a special restricted number, especially for some executive folk, such as obviously the folk I'm looking at present, which are hiding behind Ed Wellman and obviously Katie Grimason. We have the legends that are indeed Alan Stevens and obviously front and centre Fiona Moore. Alan and Fiona, how are you?
Pretty good.
Oh, excellent, right. Sounding as though you're actually on Scaro there for the moment, but I think we managed to sort that whole thing through. Well, what we can't obviously talk about this grand 50th thing, which has finally arrived long after Michael Grade thought it was never going to happen, without reflecting back on some of the key elements that were featured last Thursday night with all sorts of special bonuses and so on and so forth. Of course, the dramatisation is put together by Mark Gatiss of the original incarnation and the journey that, that Verity Lambert took in an adventure in space and time.
And you have actually watched this one, have you?
I have actually watched this one, and I've actually also caught the interesting link with the... Exactly.
Oh, yes.
Well, oh, finally.
And the Sisters of Khan and all of that malarkey that's actually
there.
You like
that?
I think it's an interesting way of incorporating the Big Finish aspects and a whole range of other things into the real-life canon, because we even had a thank you to Chris and to various companions that were actually featured there, including Charlie and so on. So it's
No, Charlie's not a companion. Charlie is the Eighth Doctor's drug habit.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Well, I'm not sure if it is entirely a fit for Big Finish. I mean, they later had an idea that he started dressing like Eccleston, didn't they, that... Paul McGann's character did, and yet he wasn't dressed as Eccleston in this story. He was kind of like a dirty down version of his costume from the movie. I think there were ever a couple of things wrong that were different. The thing is, you see, there's a number of continuities concerning Paul McGann's Doctor, partly from the book and partly from Big Finish, and they don't necessarily mash up. And I think there was something concerning the Time War. I remember looking on YouTube and someone's complaining about how the Time War as portrayed in the, or McGann's involvement in the Time War as portrayed in the books, was contradicted or whatever by the Moffat thing. I think Fiona might be more aware of it than I am.
Sort of, yeah. Now, as near as I can remember, because it has actually been probably about a decade since I read the relevant BBC books, but the Time War as played out in the BBC books actually involved Faction Paradox, so there's a nice plug here, people. Mm. And a different set of companions, you know, a whole load of time paradoxes, and basically at the end of it, the Eighth Doctor is essentially, well, you know, to segue, I read an article recently on IO9 that about the BBC and Virgin books, which was saying, you know, everything interesting in the new series was taken from there, and this is one of these things, because they have the Eighth Doctor basically doing a Matt Smith, erasing his memory and kind of reboot, and the universe's memory of him and kind of rebooting from start. For several books. So, yeah, you know, completely different.
So there is... So, I mean, did Big Finish follow the book on duty?
No, they didn't.
Right.
They never did. They always basically said, you know, kind of, you know, respect the books, clearly, because obviously several of their writers also write for the books. But
the thing is, there's so much material concerning Doctor Who, you could only really say the primary source of canon is the television version. And various things, and various things produced by Big Finish, you know, have been, or ideas have been incorporated into the show. Various things produced by Lawrence Marr have been incorporated into the show. And various things from books have been incorporated into the show. And various things brought up by fans over the years. And then there was a documentary years ago, and a little child said, "Oh, what I think would happen was that all the monsters get together, and the Doctor is put in prison on the planet, and his TARDIS is taken away from him." And that was basically the end of season 5, wasn't it? You know,
yeah.
Moffat had just seen that, and thought, "That's a good idea, I'll do that." So, you know, and even if you say the show, you know, the canon itself of the show is continually contradicting itself, because effectively it's saying that time can change, so the Doctor can go back and alter an event in the past, which will have a huge chain reaction in certain stories, won't exist anymore. I mean, this idea certainly takes place with the you know, Amy's crack, which apparently there was whole loads of Doctor Who stories from the RTD era, which no longer happen because of time changes. But this idea of changing time goes at least as far back as Genesis of the Daleks, and the Dalek timeline was completely rewritten by that story. So, you know, you're effectively standing on on sand, aren't you? What the history of Doctor Who is continually shifting.
And even then, you know, it's not even, you know, you say what appears on television is generally agreed to be canon, but even then there's slipperiness because, I mean, most people, for instance, wouldn't consider the Children in Need specials or Dimensions in Time canon.
Well, some of them are considered canon. Others aren't,
are
they?
Shada, you know, that raises a whole can of worms.
Where does that fit? Especially when you've got a big chunk of it.
Yeah, of course, you've got a remake of it with online with McGann, and... you know, it was meant to appear on television, it was never actually shown, and, you know. And then large chunks of it got recycled by Douglas Adams for Dirk Gently, so...
That's right, yeah.
So I'm wandering through various supermarkets and newsagents today, and I'm seeing the Daily Mirror celebration of 50 years of Doctor Who. I'm seeing loads of news stories, loads of newsprint. I'm seeing Focus Magazine, Science and Technology, The Incredible Science of Doctor Who, 50th Anniversary Special. I'm seeing a huge, wonderful slip-pack edition of Doctor Who magazine, which actually gives you a whole range of things, including a mock-up magazine, as it might have been if it was in existence 1 year after the series. Is this seventh heaven for Who fans or followers?
I think it's very expensive for Who fans. I think there's a lot... I mean, I read these articles and watch these various documentaries, but I'm not really learning anything new. I mean, from a fan perspective, or, you know, a fan who knows the show very, very well, a lot of his stuff is... Some of it's wrong. Other stuff is stuff I know I've heard so many times before, you know, I'm not particularly interested. There was a documentary on yesterday which was a bit more serious, wasn't it, on The Culture Show. But even then, I mean, I was thinking, yeah, I know this, I know that, and actually that bit's wrong.
Yeah, the only bit that was really interesting was when they talked about how...
Radiophonics, yeah.
Yeah, Radiophonics, and how Verity Lambert had wanted to get in this French avant-garde music group to do the theme, but they priced her out of the market. Hmm. And frankly, I am looking up these guys on YouTube because they look fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, there we are, you see. Clearly, from your own perspective, Fiona, I mean, you've produced academic texts on the Kinder episode and Snake Dance, and obviously contributed to Time and Relative Dissertations in Space, amongst other things. Can we look forward to a whole new range of undergraduate badly written theses on the series, or is it just a case of, well, it's going to be one last hurrah, or we'll be celebrating it in 50 years from now?
Oh, well, I think it's established enough in the university canon these days that I think we can look forward to lots of undergraduate theses of varying degrees of skill.
Good.
She says diplomatically.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's the way forward. You haven't been marking the recent essays I've had to mark, but never mind. That's by the by.
Oh, you poor thing. Yes. I've been doing the marking too, and well, let's draw a veil over that.
We'll move on to Who very shortly, but the one thing that I'm finding quite an interesting phenomenon of 21st century academia is we have a scenario whereby, yes, spell check might pick up in terms of the actual word names, but in terms of grammar and actually the sentences making sense, we haven't actually got a computer program that does that as yet. And it's a pity. Never mind.
Yeah. Have you heard the latest? I mean, the latest problem in plagiarism is these essay mills, you know, paying somebody to write an essay for you.
Mm. Mm. Yes, well, you know, that's a whole new world which the Doctor will have to solve. In the words of somebody who will hopefully be back on the show before Christmas, or certainly in the very near future, Annika Wills, if Patrick Troughton and Michael Craze were with me, she felt them sitting on her shoulders saying, hey, far out, this is amazing. We're referring, of course, to An Adventure in Space and Time. What did you make of it, guys? Alan first.
The Adventures of Time and Space.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Well, I tell you what, you know, talking about knowing a show very well, I mean, I did learn a lot from that. I mean, I was greatly surprised to discover that Verity Lambert, who was the original producer of the show, was so incompetent that she cast the lead man as, you know, who had senile dementia. I mean, that was incredible that, you know, that Hartnell did, you know, was so utterly useless when he began the part, and he just kept going with it. I was also amazed to learn that Warren Hussein, you know, who directed apparently every single Doctor Who episode up to the massacre, whereupon director Paddy Russell took over just prior to her sex change. Finally, I was amazed to discover that Patrick Troughton was at least 2 feet shorter than William Hartnell, you know, which suggests I should contact Character Options, because my two Character Options characters have around about the same size. So, I mean, there was lots of new information in there which I'd never realised before. You know, the idea of showers, you know, the sprinkler system would come on and cover all this electronic equipment and set in water and yet be waterproofed in 1963 and it not be a problem. Fantastic.
You see, and that's what happens when you've got the magic of Doctor Who, of course, you know, because those things are actually there. Size can change. A whole heap of other things can actually change as well. I take it then you were not singularly impressed. You didn't find it an emotional roller coaster?
I thought it was up to, when you watch something like that, you do go for a sort of mixture of emotions and feelings and stuff. I mean, the opening scene, which is very nicely filmed, takes place on Barnes Common. And Barnes Common was an in-joke reference to the Doctor Who and an Amazing Adventure of the Daleks novelization of the original Dalek story by David Whittaker, where instead of the Doctor, being discovered by two school teachers, Ian and Barbara, the scenario has changed. He's given a new beginning, and it starts of a road accident on Barnes Common. So there were certain things, that was quite clever, and that was nicely filmed. But it was really a work of fiction, to be fair. I don't think. Was it Rick Tucker?
No, it was Mervyn Pinfield.
Oh, Mervyn, yeah, Mervyn Pinfield.
Two years after he died.
Yeah. That's a but he regenerated.
My own feeling on it, actually, is that I think it deserved a series.
Right.
I mean, my big problem with it was, I could overlook some of the historical inaccuracies, particularly because of the constraints of drama. I mean, the Patty Russell having a sex change grated on me, but I could kind of see that since they're trying to compress the story into 90 minutes, they sort of feel like they want to make the point that Verity Lambert is one of very few people out there. And if they also say, oh, and hey, there was this other woman director, then it might detract from it. But the thing is, I think if you did it as a 6 or a 12 episode series and gave it time to develop and could develop it, then you could have Patty Russell. You could spend more time in the radiophonic workshop and talk about how Delia Derbyshire got her start.
You could have that huge explosion that took place behind the scenes during season 3. I mean, if you go to my Gower City website and read an interview with Donald Tosh, I mean, it's the action behind the scenes is far more interesting than what's going on screen. It's hilarious.
Absolutely, you could. one thing that trick they missed was the fact that as well as ethnic minorities and women making it in TV, there was working class people making it in TV for the first time, and some of their stories intersect with the program and need to be told. And also you could, there were some bits that were kind of compressed or exaggerated or made up just kind of for effect and to get it in. Like the one that really bugged both of us was that sequence where Verity Lambert is having a clash with a designer who just won't do the TARDIS set and then does a half-assed job at the last minute, but nonetheless it miraculously works. And
yes.
The thing is, we were both saying, if that poor designer's family are watching, they're going to be grinding their teeth because that's basically showing him as massively unprofessional.
And the misogynist.
Yeah. And I think
the BBC wouldn't work that way.
No.
In fact, it was like a production line. If you went along, if they say, right, you're doing the Mark and Moore show, and you're doing Doctor Who, and you're doing something else, and every month they'd swap to a different show, and therefore you got a great deal of experience. But if you said, oh, I'm not doing the Mark and Moore show, you'd be carpeted.
Now I can see what Gatiss was trying to do there, which is to basically kind of encapsulate that, Doctor Who was a bit of an orphan child, that drama wanted to disown it because it was a children's show, and the children's department wanted to disown it because it was drama, and a lot of people were sort of like, what are they doing assigning me to this anyway? But the fact that he did so, in this clunky, convoluted, and as I said, rather insulting to the poor fellow sequence, if they had time to develop it, then they could have showed, without, insulting the designer or being clumsy, they could have showed, Verity Lambert having to come up against people, they could have showed the contempt from both sides. They could have showed how it was sort of falling between the cracks and yet somehow managed to pull it off. But, if you're trying to compress it into 90 minutes, you've got to resort to some fairly clumsy tactics.
So really up to Mark Gatiss's usual standard then.
Oh, snap.
I'm sensing that in many ways you would prefer it if we actually followed the footsteps of the hour and actually took a six-parter over the
kinda
whole thing.
Yeah, I think they missed a massive trick in that I don't like the hour because...
that was terribly clunky.
Yeah, well, it's terribly clunky, but, it was clunky in a kind of a way of... it looked like it was imitating Mad Men and not really doing it too well. And I think,
but isn't that what BBC does on a standard matter of course, really? They take American ideas and repackage them.
Badly.
What about the whole
sending
human in the first place?
Increasingly these days. Ah. But the thing is that if they'd taken the money and resources they allocated to the hour and instead done, a based on a real-life full-length drama about, the first season of Doctor Who, then I think we'd be laughing.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of... as it goes on, there is a lot of drama going on behind the scenes. I mean, the reason why Hartnell really left was because in the production, they have his wife come up and says, "Oh yes, he's ill. He's recently been diagnosed with this illness." But the diagnosis, he wasn't diagnosed until a long time after he left the show. He didn't know he had that illness at the time, and the idea it was affecting him to such a crazy degree is just wrong. I mean, you know, everyone makes fluff, and the fact is that, you know, it was continuous filming. There was no, they couldn't cut the tape. There was continuous, so anyone, you know, having to say all this technical dialogue is going to make mistakes, and Patrick Troughton did. The only difference is that Patrick Troughton's errors were edited out, because by that point, the television had progressed. But, you know, it's a ridiculous idea to say that he was suffering from this illness right from the very beginning, and taking scenes in where he does make a fluff and really overplaying it. A friend of mine said that he thought the guy, what was his name? Stemroach, what was his name? What was his real name?
David Bradley.
He said that David Bradley was excellent as William Hartnell, but playing the Doctor, the first Doctor, he wasn't a patch on William Hartnell. And if you see William Hartnell in the final scene where he goes, you know, he's saying his goodbyes to Susan, Hartnell was brilliant, and he blows Bradley clean off the screen. You can see why Verity Lambert chose William Hartnell, because, you know, he had that twinkle. He was a great actor. And, you know, but that didn't really come over in the TV production at all. I mean, it's interesting that the guy who played Marco Polo, he was interviewed after the show, and he said that during the making of Marco Polo, Hartnell went ballistic, and they actually stopped filming for halfway through the studio day. But this was long before any, you know, idea he was ill with this. I think probably it was because at the time there was a lot of amateurishness going on. He was to do with films. He was a bit short-tempered and aggressive anyway. And he would have a tendency to blow. That was his personality. And as it went along and he became, you know, basically the only guy working on the show right from the very beginning, like Tom Baker, he suddenly believed he was Doctor Who, that he owned the show, and that no one was going to tell him what button to press to open the door. But that isn't to do with illness. That's to do with ego. That's to do with kind of megalomania. Would you agree, Fiona?
Yeah.
Mark Gatiss quoted in this edition of Doctor Who, this anniversary edition of Doctor Who Monthly, "David Bradley embraced the idea of Bill Hartnell as a pugnacious little terrier transformed by playing the Doctor."
Yeah, terrier. What do you really describe William Hartnell was a terrier?
Well, it's very much in keeping with the Southside Terriers. Did you enjoy the William Russell cameo?
Yeah,
qua cameo.
Well,
Caroline Ford's somewhat less publicised cameo.
I mean, I thought, and the casting, on the whole, the casting was very good, and I thought particularly the woman who played Barbara Wright, she was just like the original actress. So there were certain lines that she delivered and a certain look she gave. Oh, my goodness, it was almost like,
Jacqueline had come from the grave.
Stepped onto the set. It was incredible. Susan was less successful.
Yeah.
Caroline Ford was a very, very attractive woman, and I don't think this new girl was anywhere close, even in acting stakes. The guy who played William Russell looked less like him, but moved and sounded like him, so that was a good one as well. I haven't really got a problem with the casting or generally the look of a show, but I will say, I know a lot of people who were involved in making it, they were really quite surprised that there were various effects they wanted to achieve. For example, at one point in the Daleks Master Plan, Sarah Kingdom is aged to death by the Time Destructor, and they start off with the actress, a shot of her going across a desert, you know, being hit by the winds of the Time Destructor, and then they age the actress up, and then finally they brought in an old lady who, you know, then falls down and turns into a skeleton. And Mark Gatiss wanted to recreate that scene, but as the old lady, he wanted to use Jean Marsh, who was the actress who originally played Sarah Kingdom. But it was beyond their capability to do it. They just couldn't do it. It was technically beyond them. And there were a number of things they were finding when doing it that were achievable in 1963 or 1966 with Masterplan, but were unachievable now because the talent and ability available in all these huge departments of makeup and costume in the BBC in the 1960s has been completely decimated and wiped out by, you know, the BBC's idea of bringing in outside sources and cutting back the BBC. Huge amounts of talent has been lost, and stuff they could do in 63 they can't do now.
We'll hold that thought. We will hold that thought and actually come back to actually find out why you're going to be having a cinematic experience in London to actually check out the 50th anniversary episode, plus a few other views on the show, etc., after we take a wee break. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com.
How can you have confidence in your first aider when all they have is a certificate to say that no one ever failed, when you have no information about their skills, and when, according to the Resuscitation Council, 70% of CPR done in the UK is delivered below standard and inadequate? In an emergency, survival and recovery depend on the help you get before paramedics arrive. Wouldn't you rather have first aiders at work who can really save lives? Life Aiders can. Go to lifeaidtraining.co.uk for details.
So in the latest edition of Doctor Who magazine, Mark Gatiss is interviewed, and he comes up with what I think is quite a fascinating observation. There are just as many lily-livered people around today who don't have the courage of their convictions and are just waiting around for someone to tell them if a new project is a good idea or not. But every now and then, you get someone as confident and enigmatic as Sidney Newman, or Russell T. Davis, or Stephen Moffat, who can say, "Trust me, we must do it my way." And those are the people who carry you through to huge success.
Kind of true, actually. I mean, what motivates Moffat and RTD was a love for Doctor Who. They wanted Doctor Who back on the screen. They believed it was a mistake to take it off the air. They wanted to make their imprint on it, and they were willing, you know, to take risks to push that forward. So, yeah, I think that's very true. And I think there is, within the BBC, a sort of lack of initiative and a lack of drive. I mean, I think back in the 60s and 70s, there was an idea that, you know, television could change public perception, could, you know, alter society, could change laws. But nowadays, people sort of get involved in TV because they want to appear on the screen and they want high ratings. I mean, ratings in AI figures back in the 60s and 70s and 80s as well were only a very, very rough judge of how a show was. It was not the be-all and end-all. If it had been, then Dad's Army would have been cancelled after Series 1. But nowadays, they're completely based on ratings. It doesn't seem to be anything. Do you agree, Fiona, or not?
I do. I mean, I think one of the big problems is the issue of remuneration in two ways. One, you know, if you're in a situation where the talent are not getting paid very much, but the managers are getting paid huge amounts, and particularly in a situation where there are other markets where the talent are getting actually paid quite a bit, then, you know, the sort of people that are going to come are the sort of people who want to be managers, not necessarily people who want to make good programs. And the people you do get who want to make good programs are eventually, even if they love the place, they're eventually going to go elsewhere. And the other thing is, one thing that really kind of worries me about the last 30 years, really, because I think this started in the 80s, you know, the kind of downgrading of the idea of public service. I mean, when I was a kid, I don't know if this is the same there, but there was this kind of idea that a public sector job might not would be paid adequately, but not necessarily as well as a private sector job, but there was kind of more prestige and honor attached to working in the public sector. You know, you were giving back, you were helping the public, you know.
Isn't that just the cult of the amateur, though? Isn't that the sort of notion of somehow professional or somewhat less normal and less sort of a bit grubby, basically?
Well, I say not so much, because I'm talking about a childhood in Canada here, and in Canada there isn't really very much of a cult of the amateur. You know, there is still very much that, you know, Canadians respect people who have entrepreneurial skills and who earn money. Engineers, for instance, in Canada get a lot more respect than they do over here. And, you know, professional is not a dirty word, but there's still this kind of idea, nonetheless, that the thing that I'm kind of getting at is that, you know, it seems to me that if, I tell the students, one of the subjects I teach is expatriate recruitment, and one of the things I say is that the easy incentive to go for when you're recruiting executives is money. But the fact is that when you're sending somebody away to a foreign country for 3 to 5 years, usually the ones who are just in it for the money are the ones that have the highest chance of failing out, you know, not completing the assignment. But you need to have some love for the job as well. And it seems to me that, you know, people have kind of got away from the idea that you should love your job, that you should give something back, that, you know, a job is not just a job, it's a vocation, if you like.
Well, that there are a whole heap of various political experts who would have a number of people to blame for that. No names, no pack drill, but shall we say they're mostly from the right wing. Anyway.
Yes, well, I think John Burt did more damage to the BBC than anything.
He became a knight, didn't he?
Yeah, and that speaks volumes as well, when that sort of person is rewarded with knighthoods and directorships and lucrative consultancies. And what you're basically saying is that the person who sells off the family jewels and tells everybody to do blue sky thinking is rewarded, then that's the sort of person you're going to get.
And another thing kind of irritated me about that space and time was the idea of this kind of Heath Robinson style, you know, amateurishness, you know, where there was a kind of boffinish genius who could create the TARDIS set in 5 seconds. The BBC was a factory full of a lot of talented people. People who'd come in from the film industry, people who'd come to BBC, worked as apprenticeships, who worked on many, many shows, and had a huge, vast amount of knowledge. And that effectively has gone. And people are not invested in the show, in the programs they're working on, as they were back then. And they weren't, the structure isn't there anymore. A friend of a friend of mine who worked on that documentary recently, the 90-minute documentary, a friend of his own, that said, that wasn't really very good, was it, that Channel 3 thing? He said, well, look, if it hadn't been for me, he said, there wouldn't have been any old clips from Doctor Who at all. The people working on documentary were completely indifferent to Doctor Who, didn't understand Doctor Who, and basically just wanted to promote the show as it currently was. So I really had to work hard to get those clips in.
Yeah.
So, there is this kind of, it's sort of lack of... What would you call it, Fiona?
Passion.
It's almost like,
passion,
I'm on a 6-month contract and I'm going to move on
I was going to mention this, but as you know, I was hosting a debate at the London Weekend Television headquarters, that was now ITV, on ageism in the media with Nick Ross and various other folk, and similar sort of messages were coming out. We do seem to have lost certain elements of passion in terms of the whole sequence there. Although, do not despair. The world will work through, I have no doubt. Let's move on to another little quote, this time taken from a Benjamin Cook interview with, of course, Jenna Coleman. I felt like the luckiest girl in the world having three doctors to play with. Does this open up the opportunity that, as we look for, obviously, the official episode itself? And I have to say, the BBC did produce what for me was the best audio documentary, not on Doctor Who earlier this week, but narrated by Robert Vaughan on his own experiences of the whole Kennedy presidency, which I thought was excellent. Pity that the Jeremy Vine minute-by-minute thing didn't quite manage to work that through, but I'm sure it was a good idea at the time to make Friday night his music night into a commemoration of the assassination of the late John F. Kennedy. But where will you be watching the episode this evening? Because you're not going to be sat in front of your television set, are you?
Well, we all know that, today is a famous birthday. Because Fiona, of course, was born on the 23rd of November, 1975, wasn't it, Fiona?
74.
This is just birthday. Happy birthday, Dr. Fiona Moore.
I've to go with her doctor, doctorship, I've given her a sonic screwdriver for her birthday.
I should hope so.
Yes, you have. Yes. It's a beautiful sonic screwdriver.
Yes, she'll be taking this sonic screwdriver to hopefully break into Stain Cinema to watch Doctor Who in 3D at around 7:30 tonight. Apparently, originally, it was just going on at 7:30, wasn't it? But now they've extended the screenings by about another three or four.
Okay. Yeah, it was just once, when the tickets went on sale, I was there about half an hour after the box office opened to buy tickets, because I thought they'll go fast, and they did, but they've now opened up two screenings at 7:30, with extra screenings at 9:30, 11:30 at night, and 12 o'clock the next day.
I think originally they were going to be just 400 cinemas showing, but now there's about over 1,000 cinemas, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's huge. And it's being shown simultaneously in every country, like Sweden and Russia. My goodness.
And
so it's certainly a worldwide phenomenon.
Oh, yeah.
It's like that Beatles thing. Remember that Beatles thing they did back in the 60s where it got the huge satellite satellite link?
Yeah.
Had, 100 million people watching it. I don't know how many people were watching. Yeah. The highest ratings for Doctor Who ever were 16 million for the City of Death in 1979. That was mainly down to ITV being on strike. So it's going to be interesting to see if this figure actually beats that one. But, whether it's any good or not is another question. I think it'll be all right. What do you reckon?
I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Manage those expectations.
Of pulling off a brilliant story.
Manage those expectations.
Yeah, so did I. I actually like McGann. This is amazing. I thought it would take quite a lot to get me to like McGann, but it took me 6 minutes, as it turns out.
Oh, by the way, I've got to mention this. 50th Anniversary Week special, 50% off Faction Paradox.
So
the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who, we're making all-air Faction Paradox products available for half price, including special offers and multi-buy deals. All full sets of Faction Paradox CDs will also include an autograph from Sutek himself, Gabriel Wolf. Buy Faction Paradox and catch up on the events of the Time War, or introduce a friend. But the offer ends on Friday the 29th of November, so you better, you know, get going.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's which is the day after, of course, we'll have invited you back to comment on the event itself, because I figure rather than do a sort of an immediate response, you need to have time to sort of cogitate, probably review it, catch it a few times, and then obviously sort of share with us on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition the views and thoughts of the whole sequence. So, Alan Stevens and Fiona Moore, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic birthday link with us today on, of course, 50th anniversary of the show Doctor Who, looking back and looking forward?
I had a great time.
Yes, it's very nice.
And, of course, you can listen to the whole thing again because, you know, the podcast will be up free of charge in probably about an hour or so from now. You know, it's fantastic. It's going out live and then you can download it and you can even, you know, just sort of play it again and again, all the rest of the bits and pieces. So that's on southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. So I take it then you will both return?
We will return.
Yes, we will.